Welcome to The Science of Us, a series by The Science of Psychotherapy. I'm your host, Richard Hill.
In 1987, I was desperate. I had finished 20 years of a long drinking career, and I was sitting in detox trying to figure out how the hell I got there. I knew that I had lots of genetic risk. My maternal grandfather died of alcoholism. He died on Skid Row, actually. And all three of my uncles died of it. And so I'm sitting in detox saying to myself, is this going to happen to me too?
That was Dr. Oliver Morgan talking about a turnaround moment in his personal struggles with alcoholism. He went on to create a disease model of addiction and treatment. But there was a paradigm shift awaiting Oliver as he left treatment for his addiction and went back to finish his doctoral program on addiction recovery and start to question the status quo. In this episode of The Science of Us, we look at the relationship between addiction and attachment. In 1987, Oliver didn't find a lot of research on addiction recovery, but he did have experience with addiction, and so in his first post at the University of Scranton, he was asked to, quote, do whatever he thought needed to be done, unquote, with the course material on addiction.
There was nothing in recovery. It was basically, these are drugs, this is what drugs do to you, and that's the end of the story. There was nothing about recovery or which is a different animal. So I started changing the courses. I was adapting them and moving along, and I worked in things that were becoming more important.
Oliver started to change the addiction course material with ideas about intervention that were not the established disease model, a model that didn't fit Oliver's experience as a clinician or in the classroom or his own personal experience with addiction. And then a critical moment. Oliver ran into Robert Ander at a conference.
We're grateful to have Dr. Rob Ander, who is one of the principal investigators with the Adverse Childhood Experience study that was conducted with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Kaiser Permanente in Southern California back in the 90s. Without further ado, Dr. Rob Ander.
Thank you. Let me just give you a little bit about my background and how I got into this.
Basically, what he convinced me of was that underneath addictive behavior, and more so underneath people's tenacity holding on to it, not wanting to let it go, there were hidden motivators, hidden drivers, and those drivers were trauma.
Yep.
That idea really captured my way of thinking.
For Oliver, the question now became, quote, if trauma was a big motivator for addiction, what are the mechanisms? How do we get from trauma to addiction? Unquote. He turned to neurobiology to understand what was going on, and from neurobiology to attachment, bringing him to the basic premise that addiction is an attachment disorder. The psychobiological and social development that occurs in early childhood to form secure attachments may also be the foundation for addictive disorders if secure attachment fails to develop. Oliver started to view addiction as a disorder of attachment and human connection. He started to see how someone's unfulfilled interpersonal needs could look to a drug, an activity, or a behavior to partially fulfill that need. It may be a poor substitute, but an available substitute nevertheless. All that is required is for the drug or activity to, quote, have what it takes, unquote, in order to fill the role of substitute. Unmet attachment needs can be addressed, even if only partially, by a relationship to addiction. When secure attachment does not develop, the capacity to regulate internal states and subsequent behavioural responses can suffer, sometimes significantly. This is especially true in the critical first 18 to 24 months of rapid brain development, where attachment bonds are particularly important. Without a robust internal regulatory system to navigate the often turbulent world, extrinsic forces are often employed to substitute the lacking secure attachment. These substitutes may be drugs, but also food, gambling, sex, work, or some other activity that emulates, neurobiologically, aspects of relationship and attachment. Oliver had found the mechanism of addiction that was completely missing in the disease model of the 1980s.
It took me a long time to claim my own trauma history and to understand what was going on. So how did I wind up in treatment and in that detox I started talking about? And once I finally understood my own trauma history, it lit up the rest of the research. My family tells a story that when, after I was born, I didn't sleep through the night for the first 11 months of my life. This is the story. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a family story. All right. Okay. So it's a bit pathological and it's got other things, but, and I didn't sleep until my parents, being totally exhausted, standing over my crib saying, if he doesn't sleep tonight, we're going to have to put him in the basement. Right. And of course, I slept that night and every night thereafter. That story really told me a lot about what was going on at home. The truth is, as I found out much later, not long ago, actually just a couple years ago, the truth is that when my mother found out she was pregnant with me, I'm the caboose. So everybody else was at least 8 years older. She went into a depression. And she went into a depression in part because she was planning to leave my father. Now, this is 1949. You know, people didn't do that. And then once I was born, that depression deepened into a postpartum depression. Right. So much so that my dad had to call my grandmother, her mother, to come take care of the family, because she couldn't get out of bed, she couldn't. And I started thinking about what was that infant like for those first 11 months? And I realized that there was, you know, there's a psychoanalytic theory called the dead mother that talks about what happens with infants if they're interacting with a caregiver who's very, very depressed. And it's like the infant is trying to reach out to work with a dead mother. Of course, then plays into attachment issues, you know, whether it's ambivalent attachment or anxious avoidant or whatever. So that really helped to frame some of my own way of thinking about it.
We started recovery in 2006. It was just an outpatient group therapy for addiction. And at that time, especially in Alexandria, things were very, very underdeveloped in the addiction rehab services. And the main service at that time was only the detoxification service for most of addicts. And so we tried to start an outpatient group. It was a very, very, very small group. We only had three patients, and we didn't even have a place for the group setting. So we used to mobilize them into the hospitals that we were working on. And we stayed this with nobody getting any results for about 7-8 months. Nobody. So patients came, attended the group, and went to use drugs.
That was Dr. Sharif Darwish, an Egyptian psychiatrist in Alexandria. He started his medical career with the intention of becoming a cardiologist, but shifted to psychiatry in his early days of training at the Mamura Hospital for Psychiatry and Addiction. This is the largest Ministry of Health hospital in northern Egypt, with about 1,000 psychiatry and addiction inpatient beds and an outpatient clinic that covers some 400 patients per day. Sharif remembers his first day when he stood in the middle of a very long corridor of one of the wards, looking at all the needs before him. It was an intimidating experience. In less than a year, he was playing football with the patients and having friendly conversations with them, learning more from them than he could have from any textbook on addiction. His passion for psychiatry grew each day as he started to see each patient as a unique case, a unique and very human journey. It was 2003. Standard addiction treatments were largely ineffective. There was a huge drug addiction problem in the country. And Sharif decided this was the area in which he wanted to make a difference. Inspired by the changes he saw in his patients simply through interpersonal relationships, Sharif and a colleague started to develop a program for addicts that was very different to the status quo. With just a small group of people, Sharif started to build a recovery program and a recovery center that was more akin to building a family than an institutionalized program. They created a welcoming environment, painted the walls, furnished the place, they held barbecues, all just themselves. Not the usual practice for a psychiatrist in Egypt, but Sharif was passionate to make a difference in his community.
At that time, it was only me and my partner. We were the co-founders. And we did everything from painting the walls of the rehab until we put everything in, and then the patients. And we used, on Thursday, we used to have a barbecue that we did ourselves. We just got a cook and a couple of workers and a nurse, and, you know, very, very basic team.
From this basic team, Sharif built a recovery unit with a growing understanding of the emotional and relational issues of his patients. There was a common element of deep trauma among the patients. This deep trauma was often childhood abuse, physical, sexual, or emotional abuse. What became obvious at the clinic was the patients' need to be seen and heard because of attachment breaches in childhood. And this had become the main driver for the addiction they had fallen into. This was exactly what Oliver had discovered. It was an attachment issue. These patients needed a family where they could be accepted and loved while also attending to chemical dependency and the other issues that accompany drug addiction.
The need to be seen, the need to be heard, was the main drive for them for addiction. And that's why we always call it the recovery family. You know, that we are not just treating people and pushing them away. We are always trying to keep our connections with everybody. And we Ramadan is our holy month in Islam. And so people always have breakfast. You know, we fast all day and we have breakfast by sunset. So breakfast time is always a social gathering for families and so on. And we've been having this social breakfast in Ramadan in recovery in the facility for about 7 years now. Right. And lately, you find like we always do this count of years of abstinence in the people who come, you know. So, for example, I'm abstinent for 1 year, you're abstinent for 2 years, so we have 3 years, and so on. So, for example, last year, there was about 460 years of abstinence in the breakfast.
When we come back, we'll discover more about addiction to many things that can be characterized as an attachment disorder. Stay with us. We have more to discover about addiction and attachment from Oliver and Sharif and some special new guests in just a moment, but I just want to tell you a little about the science of psychotherapy. As a practicing clinician, it can be very difficult to stay ahead of the latest research, and simply identifying what's applicable to your practice in a sea of information can be very challenging. And this is where the science of psychotherapy can help. We curate articles and short courses and video programs and bundle them all together in one convenient place. research at your own pace, and engage with a community of professionals. Just become a standard subscriber of The Science of Psychotherapy at thescienceofpsychotherapy.net. And now, back to our program. Dr. Oliver Morgan explains that when secure attachment does not develop, the capacity to regulate internal states and subsequent behavior responses can suffer, and sometimes significantly. This is especially true in the critical first 18 to 24 months of rapid brain development, where attachment bonds are particularly important. Without a robust internal regulatory system to navigate the often turbulent world, extrinsic forces are often employed to substitute for the lacking secure attachment. Now, these substitutes may be drugs, food, gambling, sex, work, or some other activity that emulates, neurobiologically, aspects of relationship and attachment.
You know, the people who experience trauma don't just have a memory of it, particularly if it's childhood trauma. A lot of the childhood memories are in our bodies. They're not in explicit memory pictures. They're in our bodies. Knowing that there are people out there who have implicit memories like that, and also that it shapes the kind of brain circuits we have, our needs for caregiving, holding, comfort, and people who don't have that early on, where do they search for it? What's their model for being able to be comforted, to find buffers for the stresses in their lives? And I think that's one of the ways that I think about addiction as chemical comforters. You know, the way to begin to cope with the stresses in one's life.
In his new book, Addiction, Attachment, Trauma, and Recovery, The Power of Connection, Oliver says, I quote, "The lust for power or wealth can be every bit as addicting as heroin and just as deadly. And while it is tempting to limit our thinking to psychoactive chemicals and compulsive activities, human beings have the capability of utilizing many other elements of living into counterfeit substitutes for true relationships."
Chemical comforters? They're not just chemicals. You know, we know that drugs and chemicals are one form that addiction takes. But behavioral compulsions, gaming, gambling, sex addiction, is also really important, as the World Health Organization has recognized. And then my students would laugh right now because they know what the next thing coming is. I have this third group of things that we do, aholias, which are workaholism, yeah, addiction to wealth, to status, to celebrity. Those things can be every bit as captivating as drugs can be. And in some ways, those aholias are our most dangerous ones. You know, I say to my students, if you're not sure that addiction to wealth is a real addiction and very dangerous, look at the Amazon. Look what we're doing to the planet. And that's, it's all about making money and finding security.
These substitutes for attuned human connection provide an element of momentary emotional management, but the side effects are often much worse than the cure. The reward system in the brain can become so sensitized to the drug cues that it becomes somewhat disconnected from the higher prefrontal cortical control. The addict literally mindlessly goes back to the addictive behavior or substance without that much needed cognitive appraisal. But are the insecurely attached addicts forever stuck with only substitutes to real connection that brings emotional regulation and stability? Oliver, along with a host of others, went back to the work of Mary Main, who points us to attachment repair and what Main calls earned secure attachment. This is the capacity, despite the lack of secure attachment in childhood, for adults to understand and make sense of their history, and why they do and feel the way they do today. And in making sense of their history, they can create a new narrative for themselves, a narrative that has the power to alter the neural architecture of autobiographical memory that has trapped them in insecurity.
The purpose of all addictions, of course, is to give you relief from internal angst, internal discomfort, and also to create a feeling of euphoria so that you feel like you're floating and you're not fully present. And the only reason that people want that is because they're not inside feeling a lot of joy and a lot of connection and a lot of love.
That was Robert Jaffe. He and his partner, Mitra Rashidian, are experienced therapists in the field of addiction. They are familiar with the intimate connection between addiction and attachment.
I experienced people going through recovery as having experienced either abuse, abandonment, or neglect in their early years. And sometimes all three, sometimes two of the three, but all of those lead to a feeling of disconnection and alienation because you're not seen and appreciated and loved for your authentic true self.
Robert touches on the core driver here, a feeling of disconnection and alienation. In a recent study from the University Medical Center, Hamburg-Eppendorf in Germany, researcher Andreas Schindler highlights the link between insecure attachment and substance abuse disorders. She says that, quote, longitudinal studies and meta-analyses indicate that secure attachment is a protective factor against substance abuse, and insecure attachment is a risk factor for substance abuse. Taken together, the general link between insecure attachment and SUDs today is well established. And there is moderate to strong evidence for the assumption of insecure attachment being a risk factor for SUD. Unquote. The study also suggests that treatment approaches should consider insecure attachment and that specific engagement strategies would be required given the difficulties establishing relationships with insecure substance abusers. So how do therapists like Oliver and Sharif treat addiction today? For Sharif and his team, they have kept personal connection central while integrating CBT, DBT, psychodynamic and other modalities all together. Everything is individually tailored for the patient, and a concept might be followed through with the patient during a week involving some CBT, maybe some play therapy or some psychodynamic. It's all approaching the same concept from these different angles, all the while emphasizing love and acceptance from peers and professionals at the center.
CBT was not enough, you know. So we started integrating other modules of therapy. So we started with CBT, and then we got more training in cognitive analytic therapy. And then we shifted more to dynamic therapy. And then we had the DBT. We had some intensive training from Linhan Institute. So we integrated some of the DBT. And now I can't say that we are now working on a CBT model more than a more of an integrative model.
Yeah.
What we found out by time is that addiction is not just about using drugs or abstinent or tricks to stop the drug use and to stay sober, but it's about a deep trauma in most of our patients.
Sharif tells us that one of the first things they focus on is priorities for the patient. Often they come into therapy where everything's an emergency and urgent, and the goal is to sort out what is not important, what is important, or what is urgent. When everything is urgent from the patient's perspective, then the treatment is seen as urgent and they want to get through it as fast as possible, which becomes detrimental to their progress. Bringing awareness to what may be important but not urgent, or not an emergency, is an important perspective for the client to gain, and it helps with planning and executing activities and reaching goals, while all the time reducing the anxiety. Patients often come into the program when they have hit rock bottom, and that is their motivation to change. Sharif will contemplate with the patients at this stage, the losses that they have suffered from the drug abuse, helping to reinforce the fact that they need to change. But often the patients will think that if they stop taking drugs, they will get the benefits of not using drugs immediately. Thinking in this way can be completely demotivating when the benefits don't magically materialize. The program brings to them an understanding that after the losses from taking drugs, then there's the losses from not taking drugs. In other words, there is a cost to recovery. The length of engagement for each patient is variable and completely open-ended. It all depends on the patient and their responsiveness to the program. Sharif is careful not to prejudge anyone coming into the program, and he actually cannot tell from the referral or in initial intake as to their success.
We have research that gives us some drugs that we can intervene with. So we have naloxone now, we have a number of other things, but that's going to be a limited success rate. What we really need in rehab is to think more synthetically about how to work with people. So approaching addicts and trying to get them into treatment through their families.
Right.
So the ARISE program, CRAFT, that Bob Myers has put together, there are ways to work with the family so that we can approach people who need to get into treatment. But then treatment has to begin to be very different. You know, there's a whole area of research now in the United States about the treatment industry, that it's really locked in an unhelpful way of thinking about how to approach people.
Right.
And what we have to do is be much more open, much more thinking about recovery as a lifestyle, rather than getting people to a point where they can graduate from treatment and be okay now. They can go off and live their lives. Recovery is an ongoing thing, and really we need to think about it that way. And in part, what I think that means and what we're starting to see in the United States and other places is that recovery-oriented systems of care have to begin to take over for people who are in a recovery lifestyle.
Oliver goes on to explain the importance of ongoing connections in the community, in the programs, the threads of attachment that keep the recovered addict from seriously relapsing. The theme is the same for Sharif in Egypt. The most important part of the program is the relationship. The playing of volleyball together, breaking the Ramadan fast together, forming strong bonds with others that are recovering. And beyond the walls of the center is the ongoing work of forming new friendships that satisfy the attachment need, something Sharif and his team have achieved for many of their patients.
What we're learning from places like Portugal and Switzerland and other places, so that rather than spending a ton of money on law enforcement and other kinds of things like that to fight addiction, they're actually reinvesting some of that money into helping people rebuild their lives, rebuild their connections into the societies that they've kind of opted out of. So providing funds so people can start businesses, finding safe housing for people. And we're finding some of those things being tried in specific cities in the United States. I think Seattle is one of them. And we're seeing some real success.
We do have breaking news tonight from Cairo, where after a day of unprecedented violence, the night gives way to armed chaos.
Bill, good morning. It has been a very, very ugly night, and it could shape up to be an even uglier day. This after violent protests all day yesterday. It's quieter now as dawn is breaking and people now are pouring into the square, but for at least 2 hours in the pre-dawn hours, there was shooting, heavy shooting, into the protesters and into that square where women and children also have been all night.
During the political upheaval of the Egyptian spring, Sharif told me that the police disappeared, leaving only the military, who were not concerned with general law and order. And local neighborhoods had to organize their own checkpoints to help protect their local communities. Unfortunately, the loss of law enforcement was an open door to drug merchants. Sharif could see that they were setting up near the neighborhood checkpoints, and the whole situation just seemed to spell a recipe for disaster. To his surprise, none of the recovered addicts from the recovery center relapsed. When he finally got around to asking them what this was all about, the universal answer could be summarized as, quote, "We did not relapse because what we were doing to protect our families and our community was too important," unquote. Well, we think this says it all. When the ex-addict's intrinsic motivation to protect our families and community overrides any enticements to relapse, it seems that a deep healing has taken place within them. And they have remade a connection with their community and their families. This attachment repair is the focus of Oliver's therapeutic process, as it is with Sharif in his Egyptian centres. Changing the default narrative of an addictive patient is better done in the context of secure relationships. The family that Sharif nurtures, the interpersonal sensitivity, empathy and love that Oliver demonstrates with his clients. Within this context of human connection, there is a greater chance of re-engaging those prefrontal areas of cognitive appraisal about what the addiction is doing to them. Co-regulation can happen between the client and therapist. The reward system that is wired to respond to attuned human connection starts to respond to cues other than the addiction, and the elevated baseline of reward system, it begins to come down. Understanding is gained, narratives are altered, and positive feedback loops are established that align neural architecture with this new narrative. Part of this new narrative is sense-making of the past. Other parts of the narrative revolve around the newly experienced reality, that they are someone of worth, someone seen, heard, and valued, someone loved and respected. Love and acceptance is indeed a powerful drug. Oliver describes that there is then an important goal for counselling. Quote, "The co-creation of a new, safe, and more secure interaction. Over time, this may supply a corrective, reparative, relational experience. The same kind of attunement or misattunement, rupture, and reattunement, repair, processes that can cultivate synchrony in a new healing dance that brings healing and openness to learning from experience once again. Social engagement, as opposed to defensiveness, takes over the process." Unquote.
Addiction and trauma disconnects people. Mm-hmm. It fragments their lives. And finding ways to build social engagement back into people's lives is really important. I just saw there's a new movie. I don't know if it is coming to Australia or not. There's a new movie in the United States called Recovery Marathon. And this is about a group of people doing exercise and training for a marathon together. They're all in recovery. And it's about their interrelationships among each other. There are other things in the States. Phoenix Multisport is another one where people are doing skiing and other kinds of exercise things, but staying together. It's like having a social club built around recovery, but also around exercise. These are very interesting.
Once there is a safe and secure co-regulation process happening between client and therapist, Oliver suggests there's a good opportunity to revisit painful memories of the past and juxtapose them with the new narrative and understanding that the client has about themselves. Well, this brings the opportunity for memory reconsolidation to occur and fundamentally change the old mental schemas about self-worth and disarm those defensive mechanisms. Both Sharif and Oliver have not really discovered anything we didn't already know about the neurobiology of attachment, nor have they shown us anything surprisingly new about the chemical dependence. But what they have done for therapeutic intervention is take the spotlight off purely chemical dependence in the reward system and replaced it with a floodlight on the entire attachment paradigm as the primary issue. The 12-step program for addicts has a strong focus on relationships, and that may be one of the reasons for its efficacy. But now, Sharif and Oliver, just to showcase two of the wonderful practitioners in this area, are taking the science and practice to another level. And we think this is significant for the field of addiction. This episode of The Science of Us was written by Matthew Dalitz, audio production by Jake and Dalitz, and presented by Richard Hill. To find out more, please go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.